and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
People, do not abandon your values for a temporary fix.
I believe we just saved hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs.
City Council debates whether to delay the end of the tipped minimum wage.
Without action from Springfield, these resources will vanish.
Chicago Public Schools is facing a $730 million budget deficit. A look at the potential impact. And Ebola is spreading on the other side of the world. How is Chicago preparing? First off tonight, the city of Chicago has a new government watchdog. City Council members today unanimously confirmed David Glockner to serve as the city's next inspector general. The former assistant U.S. attorney vows to, quote, prioritize problem solving over finger pointing. Mayor Brandon Johnson's pick to lead the office says he'll also work to speed up investigations. Glockner worked for ComEd parent company Exelon, overseeing the company's efforts to comply with a deferred prosecution agreement resulting from the scandal that sent former House Speaker Michael Madigan to federal prison. Survivors of domestic violence and families of fallen first responders are calling on the city and the county for stronger enforcement of people with domestic orders of protection, criminal warrants, or on GPS electronic monitoring systems.
Like me, so many feel that the court system is entirely broken. First, we are harmed by our abusers, and then by the dysfunctional systems meant to protect us.
Several alder people, including 23rd Ward Alderman Silvana Tabarez, are backing a resolution calling for a hearing with Cook County law enforcement and circuit court officials to address concerns and improve transparency. The group points to the deaths of two Chicago police officers and two Chicago firefighters who died in the line of duty in separate incidents where the alleged offenders had active court warrants. The group notes that of the nearly 4,400 defendants on the county's electronic monitoring program, the chief judge has confirmed 8% of them are missing. Chicagoans love a good name, because if you thought naming a snowplow was fun, just wait till you hear the finalists for the two baby bald eagles found hatched in Park 597 of the Chicago Park District. The eaglets are the first born in the city limits in more than 100 years. More than 3,200 possible names have been submitted in the Park District's naming contest. The selection committee has narrowed it down to Migizi, which means bald eagle in Ojibwe. Marion, a nod to Marion Burns, the Chicago environmentalist with strong ties to the city's far south side. And Calumet, that's a play on Calumet, the southeast side region where the eaglet's nest is located. You can head to our website to learn where you can cast your vote. And there is more Chicago Tonight that's coming up. But of course, first, we wanted to share details about a special upcoming event. You're invited to join us for a WTTW News town hall about police community relations in Chicago. It's on Tuesday, May 26th at 6 p.m. at Thalia Hall in Pilsen. You can reserve your free tickets at WTTW.com/events. Tickets are limited, so sign up today. Again, that is at WTTW.com/events, and we'll see you there. Up next, Heather Sharone joins us live from City Hall right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
The Chicago City Council approves a measure designed to rid the Chicago Police Department of officers with ties to hate groups and far-right extremist organizations. The vote caps a debate that has lasted more than a year. Alderman Matt Martin authored the proposal and asked for his colleagues' support while acknowledging it will not solve all the problems facing the city.
Refusing to act because one proposal is not a silver bullet, that's a mistake. We should do what we can, where we can, and with the legal tools that are available to us, and we should do it now.
Our Heather Sharone joins us now live from City Hall. Heather, what would this ordinance do?
Well, it would give the civilian office of police accountability the authority to activate, or to investigate, I should say, officers accused of actively participating in groups like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. Now, this comes after nearly a dozen officers over the last several years were accused of being members or participating in those groups' activities. And former Inspector General Deborah Witzberg said that the city fell far short of holding them accountable for those associations and making sure that Chicagoans could trust that the members of their police force were there to protect them, not to try to overthrow the federal government.
Heather, why such fierce debate?
Well, a number of older people were frustrated that this ordinance only applies to members of the Chicago Police Department. They said the ordinance should apply to all city employees, regardless of whether they are members of the police department. However, the Chicago Law Department said that such an ordinance banning associations for all city employees, including elected officials, would be unlikely to withstand legal scrutiny because it would likely violate the First Amendment. The courts have held that cities have the ability to restrict the activities of law enforcement officers because of their special roles. They carry guns, they have the ability to arrest people, and of course they're required to testify under oath that what they're saying is true, and they take a vow to uphold the Constitution. There was a lot of frustration that this ordinance is limited. While some older people saw it as an attack on the Chicago Police Department, Alderman Martin and supporters said that's just simply not true. It's also, I think, important to note that no other members of the city's workforce outside of members of the Chicago Police Department have been accused of participating or belonging to extremist groups.
In other action, Heather, the city council voted to delay the end of the tipped minimum wage for an additional 2 years. Here's Alderman Jason Ervin blasting his colleagues.
We know that your rent is skyrocketing. Inflation is up. You don't have access to the same health care and things that other communities, but we'll catch up with you in 11 years. We'll catch up with you down the road.
All right, Heather, briefly, because we're just about out of time, but what does this mean for Chicago workers who earn tips?
They will not get a raise in July. They will not get a raise in July of 2027. And people who work for large companies will have to wait for 2030 to make the overall city's minimum wage. And if you work for smaller organizations, you'll have to wait until 2023. It's a huge blow to one of Mayor Brandon Johnson's signature legislative accomplishments. Jason Ervin, as you just heard, was the only alderman to vote against this measure, making it likely that even if the mayor vetoes it, the city council will override him.
Okay. Heather Sharone, live at City Hall for us. Thanks, Heather. And you can read Heather's full coverage of today's city council meeting on our website. It is all at wttw.com/news. Chicago Public Schools is facing a more than $730 million budget deficit for next school year. CPS leaders cite rising pension payments and operating costs as factors for worsening the district's finances, but also argue that those expenses would be manageable with greater support from state and federal leaders. Joining us to break down the deficit are Austin Berg, executive director of the Chicago Policy Center, which is part of the Illinois Policy Institute, and Mikayla Blaze, a CPS board member representing District 5B with constituents in neighborhoods like North Lawndale and Garfield Park. We should mention we also invited Chicago Public Schools and the Chicago Teachers Union, but they declined. We also reached out to the Chicago Principals Association, but haven't heard back. I thank the two of you for joining us. Austin, let's start with you, please, because as we mentioned, CPS is citing rising operation and pension costs, as well as lower federal and state support as responsible factors for the budget deficit. Is that how you see it?
pension costs are definitely a factor, but the fact is we have record state revenue in CPS and record federal revenue in CPS as well. I think the real cause behind this deficit is twofold. One is that the district really went on a hiring spree during COVID against the advice of most financial experts. They were adding a lot of recurring costs on one-time revenues that they knew would go away after the pandemic was over. So that included adding 9,000 new district staff. It increased the size of the central office by 60%. Meanwhile, student enrollment fell by over 10%. It fell by 45,000 students over the same time. That's a really huge factor. And the second really large factor is the Chicago Teachers Union was demanding at the bargaining table things that were going to cost way beyond what CPS could afford. And even when confronted with that information, they pushed and they got what they wanted, but the money isn't there to pay it.
Mikayla, how do you see it? What do you think is behind the deficit?
I think CPS has been historically underfunded for decades. We haven't had the money that we were supposed to have by the state's own admission. By their own funding formula, we are underfunded. There's no surprise or mystery in the fact that CPS has not had the resources it's needed ever. And blaming CTU seems just like an easy response to a significant issue. I mean, the costs of everything are up, and we're dealing with 80-year-old infrastructure. And there's a number of things that we have to accomplish now that we need funding for.
Mikayla, you've said that the state should be doing more to fill that funding shortfall facing CPS. Explain your view. What do you think they should be doing?
So I'm not saying that the state should do more. The state said the state should do more. But they got all the experts together and they figured out how much CPS should be funded. And from their own funding formula, we're over $1 billion short. And it's not just CPS, it's schools around the state. And so we're just encouraging them to ramp up their plan to increase the funding for CPS, just get us the funding sooner than what they're actually planning for.
Of course, you're referring to the evidence-based funding formula, which is based on what it takes in that district to educate the children in the district based on its needs. CPS has also said, Austin, that it's not receiving enough federal funding. The district previously received, as you said, that influx of pandemic relief money. Those funds have dried up, and CPS, you know, used that funding, as you said. Do you believe that the district became too reliant on that pandemic aid? And is it possible that the thinking at the time was, okay, once the pandemic money is gone, the state money will start to kick in and we can afford all of this?
Yeah, but that's really irresponsible budgeting. Imagine if we did that in our household budget and you get a windfall from a lottery and you start spending like you're gonna earn, you know, $10 million a year in perpetuity, but obviously that was a windfall and you have to sock that away for a rainy day. Instead, it was spent on more and more recurring expenses, again, adding 9,000 members of the central, of district staff, increasing the central office by 60%. I do want to talk, though, about resources. I think it's important to note that there's been a lack of a realistic plan to get additional resources from the state. I should note that per pupil spending has doubled at CPS over the last decade. It's now $32,000 per student per year. But if we want to talk about those resources, I think it's important to note that City Hall has the worst relationship with Springfield of any mayor of the last 50 years. And I think that's an important thing to note. They have not been able to put forth a credible plan to get Springfield to move on this issue. There is also hundreds of millions of dollars on the table for public school students in Chicago today. If the state would just follow the example of Colorado Governor Polis and New York Governor Kathy Hochul and opt in to a new federal tax credit for education donations, that would send hundreds of millions of dollars to public school students in Chicago. But the Chicago Teachers Union and indeed Board Member Blaze have voted against that proposal. I think that is unconscionable. We need to get resources in the hands of students through private tutoring, services for students with special needs, those could all be funded with private donations if we opt into this program.
Okay, so, and Mikayla, I'm going to give you the opportunity to respond to that as well, but I also want to talk about what CPS has said about how they plan to address the deficit. In a letter to families, CEO Macklin King said, quote, CPS will make significant reductions to central office network offices and citywide expenditures. CPS made $270 million worth of similar reductions last summer. Principals are also learning about cuts at the school level, including funding for assistant principals at smaller schools, and teacher losses are expected, capped at 4 for elementary schools and 6 for high schools. Mikayla, what do you think all that is going to look like?
I think that's going to be tough. We've seen grades, we've seen improvement in turnout, and it turns out the more you invest in our schools, the better they do. So cuts to the classroom are going to be really tough, but they may be necessary if we can't find the funding in Springfield. But I don't know Mayor Johnson and Governor Pritzker's relationship, but I do know that there are a number of state legislators that are committed to making sure that CPS has what they need. And it's, again, not just CPS, it's Illinois state schools. Our rural areas are suffering as well. And we've really got to put our money where our mouth is. We have to put our money where our values are. If we care about educating our students, we have to give them what they need. It's just that simple. And so as we look at our budgets, and I'll be talking to Springfield, but I'll also be talking to City Hall. We were able to secure $520 million last cycle. And I don't think we're going to get that close, but we're going to keep pushing on all sides. I mean, that's our job as board members, is to make sure that we secure the funding that we need.
Austin, a couple seconds left. What do you think needs to be done to get CPS to a balanced budget?
CPS right now is in really serious fiscal trouble. We are the largest junk bond issuer in the country at CPS. So there needs to be a serious conversation about State Rep Curtis Tarver's bill in Springfield for a state financial control over CPS. We need to opt in to the federal tax credit scholarship program to get money into public schools. And we need better leadership in City Hall to get what we need from Springfield.
Okay, that's where we'll have to leave it. Of course, we'll keep an eye on CPS to learn what happens next. Mikayla Blaze, Austin Berg, thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, efforts to contain an Ebola outbreak. Global health organizations are racing to stem an Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo that's already led to more than 130 deaths. And while the immediate threat is still far away from Chicago, local specialists are working to make sure that we are prepared for all possibilities. Joining us are Dr. Michael Lin, an infectious disease specialist and hospital epidemiologist at Rush University, and Dr. Larry Koziolek, an infectious disease specialist and vice president of system preparedness, prevention, and response at Lurie Children's Hospital. Doctors, thanks to you both for joining us. Dr. Lin, first, what do we know so far about the outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo?
Well, this is an outbreak that's still rapidly evolving. It was first identified by the local Ministry of Health in the Democratic Republic of Congo just last Friday, May 15th. And just in a couple of days, then the World Health Organization declared it to be a public health emergency of international concern. So we know that this is an Ebola virus that has been spreading quite rapidly. The numbers are still very difficult to nail down simply because there's not a lot of information at the ground level, but we know that there are at least 100 deaths, 500 suspected cases. And it's an area where there's not a lot of stability in terms of healthcare. Although the Democratic Republic of Congo has a lot of experience with Ebola, this is something that's still very much a work in progress for response.
Dr. Koziolek, how would you say this outbreak is different from previous outbreaks in that region?
think this one differs in many ways. One, this is a strain of Ebola virus that is more unusual than the ones that have normally caused outbreaks in that region. For that reason, we don't have a ton of research on this virus. Now, the virus, it causes less severe disease than the other ones. So that's reassuring. But on the other hand, there's no vaccine or treatment for this virus currently.
And Dr. Lin, you know, since the U.S. has withdrawn from the World Health Organization, USAID has also been dismantled. How have all of those impacted the globe's ability to respond to Ebola outbreaks?
Well, we certainly worry that the World Health Organization, which is really leading a lot of the coordination across the globe for the response, that they need all the resources they can get. So the U.S. pulling out of the WHO has, I think, hampered the WHO's ability to be able to respond as effectively as before. But I understand that there's still coordination between CDC and WHO, and we're doing the same between us and local and state departments of public health.
Dr. Koziolek, planning for the threat of Ebola in Chicago, it goes all the way back to at least 2014. Give us a little bit of that history, please.
Yeah, so in October of 2014, there was a huge Ebola outbreak in West Africa. And at the time, actually, Dr. Lin and I were together in Philadelphia in October of 2014 when the first Ebola case was identified in a Dallas hospital. And what happened was, because there wasn't nationwide preparedness, two nurses unfortunately contracted Ebola, both fortunately survived. A week and a half later, Dr. Lin and I found ourselves at City Hall. Dr. Rahm Emanuel walked in, he looked at the room and said, "We're not gonna be the next Dallas." He had convened groups of healthcare leaders, public health leaders, first responders, emergency management leaders. And at that time, the Chicago Ebola Response Network was born. And we developed a citywide that became a statewide system for preparedness and response. Now, since that time, that has evolved beyond Ebola and has helped us address outbreaks related to Mpox, COVID-19, measles, and other serious pathogens in the city of Chicago.
And Dr. Koziolek, sticking with you for a second, you know, with all this planning around the response for Ebola, what is the actual risk to Chicago right now?
It's very, very low. And the reason is because we do still have great coordination. And so there's work ongoing in the Democratic Republic of Congo and surrounding countries to identify individuals before they leave the country. Today, just within the last few hours, the Department of Homeland Security has made the decision to funnel all flights from Ebola impacted areas to Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C. And so now we have a focal point in the U.S. where all individuals at risk will fly through, and they'll be able to be screened. And if they have symptoms or have risk factors, there will be systems in place to monitor them to ensure that there's no community spread.
And it sounds like what you're just saying just now is a bit of a shift from what we knew earlier in the day, where there were five specific airports, including O'Hare, where there would be specific screenings for flights coming from that region. But it sounds like you're saying now they are all going to Dulles. We won't be getting any at O'Hare. They won't be landing.
Correct, yeah. In past outbreaks, Chicago has been one of three or four cities where flights have been routed into, and that's why we have this really great city and state infrastructure to respond to that. But in this outbreak, I just reviewed the memo in the last hour, and they are all being funneled to one single airport in Washington, D.C.
Okay, thanks for clearing that up. Dr. Lin, are there treatments, vaccines available for Ebola? What can be done?
So as Dr. Koziolek mentioned, for this particular strain of Ebola virus, it's really more supportive care, but that's always been the backbone of treatment for patients with Ebola virus. And so when we say supportive care, it really means supporting the patient in terms of their blood pressure, in terms of their respiration, their ability to breathe, et cetera. So in well-resourced hospitals, we think that we can do very well in terms of getting patients through something like Ebola virus. But it certainly takes a lot of people and resources and equipment, supplies such as PPE, and that's what we're prepared to do from the standpoint of being a special pathogen treatment center.
Dr. Koziolek, we've got about 30 seconds left. What would be the next few steps if a suspected case were to show up in our area?
If a suspected case was identified, the Chicago Department of Public Health or Illinois Department of Public Health would be notified immediately. And if it's a pediatric patient, I would be contacted. If it's an adult patient, Dr. Lin would be contacted, and we would activate our biocontainment units at our hospitals to ensure that we can receive that patient safely, promptly, and provide them that supportive care that Dr. Lin just described.
Okay, sounds like we would be well prepared, and we've got the right two guests to talk about this here on Chicago Tonight. But we'll have to leave it there. I'm sure the two of you are monitoring this. Hopefully we won't have to have you back to talk about it again. Doctors Michael Lin and Larry Koziolek, thanks to you both.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
And that is our show for this Wednesday night. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletters, The Daily Chicagoan and Urban Nature, both at WTTW.com/newsletter. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.